and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the op-ed by Fethullah Gulen in Tuesday's New York Times, "I condemn all threats to Turkish democracy," which debunks all claims by Turkey's President Erdogan that Gulen is the mastermind behind the recent failed coup. Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and author of Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, "The Gulen Movement is Not a Cult. It's one of the most encouraging faces of Islam today." We will assess whether Washington will give in to the demands and blackmail that Erdogan is using to pressure the Obama administration to extradite Gulen, who Erdogan is using as an excuse to purge Turkey of all enemies, real or imaginary, as this autocratic leader seeks dictatorial powers following the failed coup that he proclaimed was, quote, a gift from God. Then we'll go to the floor of the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia and speak with Dr. Terry Madonna, a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll, a pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. He joins us to discuss Donald Trump's lead in the polls following a bounce from the Republican convention and whether the fratricide on display at the Democratic convention will deny Hillary Clinton a similar bounce in spite of the array of political heavyweights in her corner. Then finally, we'll try to comprehend the thousands of Bernie Sanders supporters, both inside and outside the conventional hall, whose boos and chants of "a vote for Hillary is a vote for Trump" prompted comedian and Sanders supporter Sarah Silverman to remark last night, quote, "To the Bernie or bust people, you're being ridiculous." Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and author of The Burn Identity, joins us to discuss why Bernie's supporters are even booing him, and in spite of him warning them that, quote, "it's easy to boo, but it's harder to look your kids in the face who would be living under a Donald Trump presidency." They seem determined to disrupt the convention and hurt Hillary Clinton's chances of being elected. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He's currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University and has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, "The Gulen Movement is Not a Cult. It's one of the most encouraging faces of Islam today." Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And in Tuesday's New York Times, there's an op-ed by Fethullah Gulen himself, "I condemn all threats to Turkey's democracy." And he's made a very straightforward and clear case that he has nothing to do with this failed coup. But he also points out that Erdogan made that statement, that chilling statement, that the failed coup was a gift from God, and fears for Turkey and its future. Your op-ed, of course, indicates that the movement is one of the most encouraging faces of Islam today. So just starting out with that, it sounds like it's the sort of the opposite of Wahhabi Islam. Is that a simple way to put it?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Essentially, the Gulen movement came out of a kind of Sufi movement in the past. He's not really a Sufi leader, but the emphasis was on dialogue between, across civilizations, the need to avoid violence, which he's seen as the bane of the contemporary world, and particularly in religious struggles, and a belief in education. He's definitely a Muslim. He wants to raise the strength and profile of Muslims and Muslim civilization around the world, but he sees the critical factor of education as playing the greatest role. He tells his rich followers, don't build mosques, build schools. That's how we're going to raise our level in this contemporary globalized world. We've got to be able to compete and be intelligent and study science and technology and all that kind of thing. So, you know, there's never been a call for an Islamic State or for a caliphate or for jihad or anything. He rejects all of those things. So the movement's not without its faults, but among all those movements out there, I'd have to say it is one of the most heartening and more modern, progressive-looking movements anywhere.
So it's called hizmet, which is the Turkish word for service. So that is their record. And, of course, this is not the first time they've been purged. They were pretty much decimated earlier when Erdogan broke with the movement. They were allies, and in that period when Erdogan really was turning Turkey around and it made enormous strides, particularly in the economic field, so I guess let's focus in on the falling out. What happened there between these two men?
Well, as you point out, they had been allies in both any religious movement in Turkey, and whether it was political or, as in the Gulen case, his movement is not a political party. It's not a political movement as such. Any movement had been pretty ruthlessly suppressed and persecuted by the longtime Kemalist ultra-secular governments in the past. So both Gulen movement and Erdogan's party were very keen on trying to raise the level, degree of democracy, get the military out of politics, put an end to the constant military intervention and coup-making by the military, as had been a sort of regular pattern of the past. And they succeeded in this. They did send the military back to the barracks, and I think there was a far greater degree of freedom for any religious people, or any movements, indeed, within Turkey to speak out. But when the Gulen movement at last and its own followers were finally able to join civil service, join as any other citizens in Turkey have been, assuming they were qualified, and a lot of them joined, among other things, the police, and many of the educated ones helped join the judiciary, partly to help guarantee the future that they would never again be persecuted by either the police or the judiciary, as they had been and before. So there was a falling out, finally. The Gulen movement blew the whistle on what seemed to be quite rampant corruption at high levels within the Erdogan government and his party, and Erdogan simply viewed the movement as a potential rival for votes from pious Turks in Anatolia.
So he conducted this purge, and now he's done a subsequent purge. It's almost like you'd wonder if there's anybody left to purge after the first one. But this second one has been so wild and so vindictive and so vengeful. One-third of the officer corps. I mean, there can't be much of the judiciary and the education department left.
No, I think there clearly were many members of the Gulen movement. Their enemies refer to it as infiltration. I mean, they were Turkish citizens who were qualified to join these organizations, or as any other, a Turk, a left-wing or a communist or whatever else would be free to join. They joined. Indeed, they had been more and more purged after the falling out in 2013, after the police released various tape recordings, telephone intercepts indicating clear acts of economic malfeasance and things. Erdogan really hit the roof and fired all kinds of people from the judiciary and the police and everywhere else. And indeed, now it's spread out to prosecuting or arresting or purging anybody with any particular political outlook who opposes Erdogan.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a Novel of Espionage and an American's Crisis of Conscience in Pakistan. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, "The Gulen Movement is Not a Cult. It is one of the most encouraging faces of Islam today." So in the op-ed in Tuesday's New York Times by Gulen himself, "I condemn all threats to Turkey's democracy," And he points out, of course, that he's been living here in Pennsylvania as pretty much as a recluse, had nothing to do with the coup. But one thing that caught my attention was that Gulen points out that Erdogan is blackmailing the United States by threatening to curb his country's support for the International Coalition Against the Islamic State. His goal to ensure my extradition, despite the lack of credible evidence and virtually no prospect for a fair trial. The temptation to give Mr. Erdogan whatever he wants is understandable, but the United States must resist it. Do you think there's any possibility of the U.S. caving? It sounds like Gulen is sending a signal via the New York Times to the U.S. government not to hang him out to dry.
Yeah, sure. And I think it's not only a signal to the U.S. government, but I think an effort in this now almost a propaganda war between Erdogan forces and the Gulen side in this struggle. But I think it's very unlikely that the U.S. would even consider it unless there's pretty overwhelming evidence that Turkey can produce that Gulen and his movement was directly involved in this. I mean, everybody has acknowledged that when you have a movement of some 1.5 million people at least across Turkey, who can answer for the actions of every single individual? But as far as the organization remotely backing it, I think it's pretty unlikely. But beyond that, I think the U.S. government is increasingly fed up with Erdogan as well. The erratic character of his policies, his long playing, turning a blind eye to the activities of ISIS over the border, Erdogan's obsession with removing the Assad regime at any and all costs, including supporting ISIS to do that. There are just case after case in which the U.S. has come to be quite disillusioned with dealing with Erdogan, and particularly angered at the charge that the U.S. or CIA had indeed even backed this coup, which Ankara has suggested. So I think it's really unlikely, and now it's a bigger issue than just Gulen. The purges that are dismaying the whole world, the destabilizing impact that this is going to cross Turkey, the chilling effect, the crushing of journalists and the purging of judiciary, all of this, I think, leaves a very, very bad taste, and it's become an issue bigger than Gulen.
And, of course, when Erdogan took over, he talked about his policy of problems with neighbors, and now he has nothing but problems with neighbors, all of which are his own doing. He's reignited a civil war with the Kurds. He has alienated the Russians, and he's had some problems with Europe over the refugee crisis. And the Europeans have, to some extent, have been blackmailed there. But now it looks like the connections to Europe are going to be frayed even further if Erdogan insists on bringing back the death penalty.
Exactly. I think Europe had already been angered by Erdogan's rather blatant bargaining over the lives of Syrian refugees by holding up what Europe thought was keeping blackmailing Europe, in effect, by saying, if you don't give us major funding, we're going to unleash the flood of refugees into Europe. So, and indeed, I think Europe has been badly turned off by the nature of these purges, the extremity of the language. Erdogan even demanded that the German government move to silence a comedian in Germany who was making fun of the Erdogan government. It's just a bit much, and I think Erdogan is now clearly sowing the seeds of his own destruction. When this will happen, I don't know, but I don't think there's really much of a sympathetic force for him now anywhere in the world.
But what about in Turkey itself? I mean, he's eradicating all of the opposition, real or imaginary, and he's still popular. His AK Party won the last election, and it seems that the secular forces are being driven underground. So what's going to undo him if he's consolidating his power at home in a Stalinist-like way?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think everybody in Turkey, and indeed outside of Turkey, most followers of Turkey, were appalled at the idea that suddenly a coup against Erdogan should have come out of the blue. I didn't expect it. I hardly know any Turkish specialist that remotely thought that a coup was in the offing, and indeed, as we know, it was a pretty fringe element. So I think everybody in Turkey rose to the occasion and said, no, we don't want any more military intervention and any more coups in our country. Even if we don't like Erdogan, we would rather defeat him and should defeat him by the ballot box rather than through a military coup. But I don't think those people who don't like Erdogan, but yet who are against the coup, I think have now been appalled by the degree of vengeance that Erdogan has employed against all his opposition. Indeed, he's even now passed, and this was before the coup, but was passing legislation in the parliament saying that people who presented a security threat within the parliament itself would have their immunity lifted, which would mean that the government can and began to go after opposition members of the parliament by threatening them with lifting of their own immunity. So it's fairly ugly. As to what's going to bring him down, ultimately, I would probably guess it's going to be economic factors. The economy has not been going well. His reckless foreign policy in the Middle East and problems with Russia have shut off the flow of some 4 million Russian tourists a year. Nobody wants to go to Turkey now because of the instability. Tourism used to be a very, very big thing in Turkey. The lira has dropped in value. I think people are wary of investing in Turkey as they had done so much in the past. A lot of things are not going to go very well, and politically, as we said, it's he's something of a pariah internationally. But you know, when this will all kick in, who knows?
Well, it seems though that the NATO base at Incirlik, which is about I think less than 100 miles from the Syrian border, where there's a civil war going on, and there are clear advantages for NATO using this Air Force base, which Erdogan wouldn't let them use for the longest time, and eventually they got permission. And now, of course, during the coup, the Turkish commander of the base was arrested, and the power was cut off, and there are apparently something of the, along the orders of 50 U.S. Nuclear B-61 gravity bombs there in bunkers, which raised some alarms. But just in terms of the future, in terms of playing hardball with the United States over extraditing Gulen, what leverage does he have? Is he going to, again, close down U.S. access to Incirlik? And what can the U.S. do in terms of pressuring him to stop his vengeful purges?
Well, in terms of Incirlik, yes, he indeed could deny the U.S. access to that base further, but in part that's cutting off his nose to spite his face. At this point, Erdogan is pretty isolated, and if he cuts all his bridges with the United States, and indeed that has huge implications for NATO and Turkey's membership in NATO and ties with NATO as well, that is going to further threaten him. So, there have also been threats from Turkey, not from Erdogan directly, at least in so many words, but saying that, you know, if the Europeans and the U.S. are not going to do what we want, we're going to turn to Eurasia, to Russia, to China for our future political orientation. I think that is something of an empty threat, but not entirely. One of the features of Erdogan's foreign policy, and his foreign minister, who deserves more of the credit, Davutoglu, was that saying, look, we're a European country, European power, but we're also an Asian power, we're a Middle Eastern power. And there are many elements in Turkey who view relations with Russia, and this is where the Turks have started historically migrated from eastern Siberia all the way across there. Russian, there are serious Turkish ties with the Eurasian continent, and Turkey's ambitious. They want to play in that game with Central Asia and all of that. So I don't think it's an either or. I think Turkey would be cutting itself off severely if it decided to play just the Eurasian card at the expense of the European one. In theory, they could have it all. They could play in both those fields, but they will lose more than the West will if Erdogan decides to cut those ties.
And just in closing, they have resumed talks with the Russians over the gas pipeline.
That's right. Turkey needs energy badly, and the two sources of energy to Turkey have ironically been from Iran on the one hand and Russia on the other. So relations with both Iran and Russia are to some extent important, and it goes beyond just oil. It's trade. They're neighbors. Russia is geopolitically very important to Turkey. So is Iran. Russia is a player in the Middle East. Iran certainly is. So I think if Erdogan decides to go that route of turning his back on the West, he's digging the hole deeper in which he's already fallen.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a Novel of Espionage and an American's Crisis of Conscience in Pakistan. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Gulen Movement is Not a Cult. It's one of the most encouraging faces of Islam today. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll go to the floor of the Democratic Convention and speak with the pollster, Dr. Terry Madonna. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. Joining us now from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia is Dr. Terry Madonna, a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin and Marshall College poll. He has written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania. And he is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Terry Madonna.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Terry, let's begin with the national polls. I want to talk to you, obviously, about Philadelphia, important swing state, a part of the Rust Belt that many think that Donald Trump has a good chance of winning over. But let's start with the national polls. The Republican convention gave Donald Trump a bump of about 3.5 points, and that's pretty much across the board, at least the four of the major polls. So that puts him ahead of Hillary Clinton by 2 points in most of these polls. So what do you think is happening in terms of the fratricide going on at the Democratic convention? Is she going to end up without a bounce if this continues?
Well, I mean, look, if we were when you're inside, and I was in Cleveland, you're inside the convention hall, and all of a sudden you're all this bad news, you know. You've got the moment with Melania Trump plagiarized her speech, and Ted Cruz didn't endorse Trump. And a lot of the pundits said, oh, no bounce. They could even lose support. So as you accurately point out, about a 3.5-point bump. And, you know, we'll have to see when other polls, you know, we're not done yet with the polls, see where the bump actually is. So I think we've got to be very careful about how this resonates out with the voters when, you know, you're inside the national media, others covering this, you know, right in the arena. You get it. You got to be careful of the view that you get. And remember, this convention has 3 days to go. And we got, you know, President Clinton tonight. We still have to hear from Vice President Biden. We have to hear from Tim Kaine and, of course, Secretary Clinton on Thursday evening. It's way too early to predict a bump. But let me just say this. The bumps over the last several election cycles have not been big. They've not been huge. You know, 4 or 5 percentage points. The average for Democrats, if you go way back to 1964 when Gallup first started to keep, you know, keep look at the bounce, Democrats a little bit above 6, Republicans a little bit above 5. Now, there have been some spectacular bumps that I won't review now for you, get too much into the numbers, but I would expect a couple of percentage bump for Clinton. I don't think we're looking at 5% plus or more, given the fact that many, many voters have already made up their mind.
So the one thing apparently that all the pundits agree on is that what is unusual about this election year and this election season is that we've never had two more unpopular candidates running against each other. Is that do you accept that premise that neither Trump nor Clinton are particularly popular?
Oh, look, there is no doubt about it. What we're staring at are the two most unpopular presidential candidates in modern history, and of course, before polls, who knows? But there isn't any doubt about it. Now, since the email situation that Secretary, not the email involving the Democratic National Committee, but the email involving the FBI investigation, her unfavorables have gone up, and the race is tight. So basically, what we're looking at now is a very tight, close race between the two candidates nationally. And the other thing is that Clinton is more unpopular now than she was just 2 weeks ago. And both their unfavorables are in double digits. And that's something very, you know, again, it's without precedent since we started to do polls and track all of that. But if I can just add something really fascinating. When we look at questions like, how closely are you following the election? Are you interested this year? What, and there's variations of those questions, the numbers are sky high. We could have a higher turnout on November 8th than we've had in the last several presidential elections, despite the fact that the voters say, well, we don't like either of these candidates. I mean, that's truly amazing when you think about it.
Well, I think you might have to credit Donald Trump with that. What do you think?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. But remember, the unfavorabilities of Clinton do run to the heart of some of her problems, which is she is viewed as dishonest. She is viewed as not trustworthy. And all of that goes from myriad problems, you know, that have afflicted her campaign from the start. And, you know, having said that, I'm also going to come back that Trump does not do well on the honesty question. You know, he's had this very provocative campaign where he's, you know, made statements that some view as misogynist, as racist, as sexist. I mean, even last night, I've been to 9 straight conventions. I have never seen a convention floor where instead of trying, you know, arguing, let's defeat the opposing candidate, it was lock her up. And Trump starts his emails, in many cases, when he mentions Secretary Clinton, crooked Hillary. And here last night, by the way, there were lock-her-up sentiments coming from some of the people in the audience. Not the delegate. I want to make that clear. Not the delegate.
So who were these people then at the Democratic convention?
They were guest passes, and it looked like they could be the Sanders folks.
I see.
And Sanders, by the way, has not gone anywhere near healing the wounds. There was, when I got in here, there was a Sanders demonstration going on outside. See where I'm heading with this. And many of the Sanders, now the delegates mostly will fall in line, but the 5,000 people on Monday and Tuesday marched down Broad Street in Philadelphia, 5,000, with a hugely progressive agenda, and many of them aren't going to vote for Clinton. They may sit it out. I'm not suggesting they'll vote for Trump, but this is truly an amazing set of circumstances. We saw at Cleveland, and now it's actually the demonstrations at Cleveland were a complete bust. A couple hundred people at best. And this one, 5,000.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Terry Madonna, who is a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at the Franklin Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin Marshall College poll. He has written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania, and he is a pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. So, again, we go back to this sort of insurrection, these surly Sanders supporters, and it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it, Terry, to see the candidate himself, Bernie Sanders, trying to calm down his supporters and tell them not to be disrespectful, because Sanders knows that this is going to play very badly to the broader country, because the whole point of these conventions is they're really infomercials that go over 4 days to attract the middle American centrist bloc who determine elections.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, the conventions are about one word, unity. Now, maybe there's another word that you want to get out of it if you don't go in unified, and neither party is, and that's called enthusiasm. If you get the unity, then you're just trying to make sure that people are excited about your candidate. You're trying to create enthusiasm, you know, among the electorate as a whole, and, you know, we'll have to see what happens here. But here's the problem. Sanders said this last night. He said, this is a movement. It transcends anyone. And that's exactly now what's going on. This is a movement. It transcends Bernie Sanders. He was the, not arguably the leader of this movement, but these are largely, staunchly progressives who do not think that Hillary Clinton is a progressive. They think she changed her position for one purpose and one purpose alone, only to win the nomination, that she's part of the dreaded establishment that hasn't done anything to get, this is them saying it, not Professor Madonna here, she hasn't done anything to get the progressive agenda passed.
So what is then the trajectory we're on here? I know things change day to day. You never know how events can turn out at these conventions. There's a lot of, as we saw with the Republicans, with plagiarism suddenly erupting, right, and Cruz refusing to endorse Trump. There are all kinds of wild cards. What's your prediction here? Are the Sanders people going to boo Hillary on her big night and rain on her parade, or walk out as many have threatened to do?
Well, I mean, the one thing I've learned is that predictions haven't held true this whole campaign. But let me start with this. They're doing the roll call vote tonight. We'll see if there's a walkout of Sanders delegates. What they do when Hillary is officially named as the nominee of the party. But we also have, at the conclusion, Bill Clinton, who not arguably is one of the most popular Democrats. But Sanders delegates aren't impressed with Bill Clinton. There were these trade agreements that he made. There was, he was governed at a very different time, and his wife was part of it. So I think it's going to help out in the hinterland with the voters, but I don't think it's going to help very much inside this hall. And we could see a walkout. We could see a demonstration. We're just going to have to wait and see.
So, Dr. Terry Madonna, let's turn then to Pennsylvania, where you're the number one polling expert on this, on the Keystone State, and it's among the Rust Belt states, that many pundits think that Donald Trump has got a chance of winning over, and thus, in other words, if he wins the states that Romney won, and then wins Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Indiana, etc., the so-called Rust Belt states, he may well win the presidency. He may get the 270 at the Electoral College. So, Michael Moore recently wrote a piece saying that he thinks Trump's going to win. That there's so much disquiet in the Rust Belt, particularly in his state of Michigan, that people are angry. And there is a theory that this whole idea of unity, which is what the Democrats are pushing for, may well not be relevant in this constituency that we have today, this angry, roiling, angry white working class alienated constituency. They're not interested in kumbaya and holding hands and being all in it together. They feel individually that they've been stiffed. And they're out to protect themselves and their family, and it's me first, and screw the rest of them. What's your reading on the electorate?
Well, right now, Romney won the white blue-collar workers in this state overwhelmingly. Now, he didn't win them as much as the national average, that Romney won them. That the Pennsylvania blue-collar workers had less of a percentage for Romney than occurred nationally. But we would expect Trump to do very well among the white blue-collar workers in the southwestern part of Pennsylvania, places where coal and iron and steel were king for 100 years. They have been in serious decline now over the course of the last 50 years. Places where unemployment is high, where there's a big education deficit. There, young people get up. They graduate from high school, go to college. They have to leave the area, or they don't return from college because there are no jobs. Romney won them, and we think Trump will, but the issue here is he's got to win them with a higher percentage of the vote. Follow that. You've got to get a higher percentage of that vote, and you just can't win Pennsylvania on that vote alone. You've got to do much better than Republicans have done in presidential elections in the suburbs around Philadelphia. That's a critical area. A, they're large, meaning they have a lot of people. They're among the largest counties in the state. And B, they have the largest percentage of swing voters, meaning they can vote R or D depending on the circumstance. Then Trump also has to do better in some of the Republican areas where the percentages in terms of support in presidential elections has dropped. So the Trump challenge is just not to win blue-collar workers. He's got to do much better in other parts of the state.
But isn't there a problem, though, in polling itself vis-a-vis Trump? Because he's a very divisive candidate, and many of the people that support him, first of all, they're hostile. They think the fix is in. They believe that there is such a thing as the liberal media and the Washington establishment out to destroy their candidate. So they're not, apparently, in telephone polls, Trump voters are not necessarily tipping their hand. Whereas the online polls, apparently, they're more.
I'm not as convinced about that theory. Uh-huh. That's this old theory that, voters don't want to tell pollsters like myself what they think. I'm not totally convinced about that. The online polls do have some methodological problems because they're often, people are self-selecting themselves to be interviewed. They're not random. And then you have a deficit with, you have to do with older people when you do that. And you have to do a substantial amount of statistical adjusting to the polls. I haven't bought into that at all. This all comes down to whether Trump can motivate these voters. Now look, the unions are going to be out in full force for Hillary. And this, even though the unions have been in decline, the unions still have a measure of support in many of these rural, old coal mining and steel mining towns, but not like they used to. But it is going to be a turnout situation. I agree. That's important. And Trump needs that vote. But he will not elect. He will not win this state, and he will not win Ohio just with this vote alone. He has to do better in other places. It's the chessboard. Some pieces are more important than the other, but they're all important.
Well, Dr. Terry Madonna, I thank you very much for joining us from the floor of the Democratic Convention in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia. And I appreciate your insight, and let's stay in touch.
It's my pleasure. Call anytime.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Terry Madonna, who's a professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin & Marshall College, where he directs the Franklin & Marshall College poll. He's written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania. And he is the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back and go to Philadelphia to speak with the award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, Will Bunch. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Will Bunch, who's an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he blogs at Attitude, that's spelled ATTYTOOD.com. He is the author of The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. And his latest book is The Byrne Identity, The Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Bunch.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me back.
And you're right there at ground zero for the Democratic Convention. And last night, they were barely holding it together. And, of course, the optics in these conventions are extremely important because they really are four-day infomercials that both parties put out to try and attract the voters in the center in the country, or at least the voters that aren't totally partisan. And obviously, there's a concern that the optics now with fratricide and booing, et cetera, going on, particularly from the Bernie supporters, whether that will continue in spite of all the heavyweights that Hillary Clinton has in her corner who are vouching for her. So how do you think this thing's going to work out? You've seen these demonstrations in and out of the convention hall. So what's your sense of whether they're going to peter out or intensify?
Well, the early evidence, and, you know, it's going to be hard to say before Thursday, or at least tomorrow anyway, but there's a little bit of a sense that the anti-Hillary rebellion is petering out a little bit. I don't know if petering out is the right word, but it does seem that some of the things that Bernie Sanders did yesterday, and not just Bernie, but also Elizabeth Warren, who's widely respected by Bernie supporters, you know, in giving Hillary a full-throated endorsement and, you know, just that the way that they did it, it seems like there was a bit of a turning point when, you know, the convention opened at 4 o'clock yesterday. And in the first hour, there was a lot of like booing every time Hillary's name was mentioned. I believe, although I didn't see it myself, but I'm told there was even booing during the invocation, which is kind of crazy. And just a few minutes later, Bernie Sanders sent a text to his delegates. I guess they have everybody's number, and they texted all of them, and they said that this isn't helping, you know, booing, turning your back, walking out, you know, various signs of disrespect were not helpful. And the mood did change slightly. There was still some rebellious types. Everybody commented, actually, that your neighbors out there in California seem to be some of the most vocal, still Bernie people. But it does seem like things have calmed down. I mean, I went to a news conference on Sunday when a network of about 1,200 Bernie Sanders supporters was talking about putting a different name in for vice president and challenging Tim Kaine, Hillary's pick, as being too much of a corporatist, you know, too much of a centrist. And that movement has totally died and like petered out. So that's not going to happen. He's not going to be challenged. So I think the roll call vote is going on this afternoon as we're talking. I think that may be the last chance for some of Bernie's people to make their voices heard on this issue. And I think the rest of the convention is going to be devoted to trying, for better or worse, to unify the party.
So when Bernie Sanders says to his supporters, it's easy to boo, but it's harder to look your kids in the face who would be living under a Donald Trump presidency, do you think that that's working? Because it seems that I'm not entirely clear about what the animus is. I understand there's a feeling, and it's been exacerbated by the release of these DNC emails, which should not be a surprise to anybody. Bernie himself made it clear that he knew they were tipping the scales against him and that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was totally doing everything she could to hurt him and help Hillary. In fact, the emails, the real damage they're doing is to the donor base of the Democratic Party, because they've released all of their private information, including their credit card accounts.
And that's a good point.
And there are a number of statements from DNC officials bad-mouthing some of these rich donors who they, you know, obviously need, because
yeah, you're right. That could be more damaging in the long run. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon. You know, I think it's kind of the devil you know. I mean, for 13 months, Hillary Clinton has been Bernie Sanders' chief rival because they've been running their primary against each other. I think the focus of Bernie's hardcore supporters has been so much on why Hillary Clinton is unacceptable to them. You know, her corporate ties, the Clinton Foundation, the speeches that she gave for Goldman Sachs. There's been so much attention on that. And, I mean, I'm with you. I don't quite get the lack of focus on Trump. I mean, certainly about 3 or 4 months ago, Bernie and his campaign pivoted to speaking out against Trump more forcefully, but it just doesn't resonate. You know, it's strange. I mean, I've been at both conventions. I spent the whole week in Cleveland, and now I'm here in my hometown, Philadelphia. And we've had far many protesters here in Philadelphia. You know, and it surprises me. I mean, frankly, you know, when you look at Trump's basically neo-fascism, for want of a better term, you know, his just blatant appeals to xenophobia, to racial animus, to those sorts of things, it's kind of disconcerting that there wasn't more of a forceful protest movement against his nomination. And there was a lot of reasons for that. Cleveland's not on the East Coast, where you have so many people who are inclined to protest live on the East Coast. People were scared about the talk of widespread arrest, talk of tear gas and other punitive measures. And people were scared about Ohio's open carry law and the fact that Donald Trump would have supporters there walking around with guns and even with assault rifles. And that did happen. I mean, there were not a lot, but there were Trump supporters walking around events who were armed. So, you know, all of those things, I think, had a chilling effect on people protesting Trump. And you haven't had that here in Philadelphia. And so people follow the path of least resistance, right? So you've had these crowds. And it's not massive, but, I mean, it's a much more noticeable vocal contingent than you had in Cleveland.
So, again, I'm speaking with Will Bunch, who's an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. He blogs at Attitude, that's spelled ATTYTOOD.com, and he's the author of The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama, and his latest book is The Burn Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. So, what did you think of the moment, you know, because some of the boos and chants that are going on, and you're right to single out the California delegation. I know one of the leading activists there. I mean, a lot of them that I've spoken to have an almost irrational, burning hatred of Hillary Clinton, and they were totally in love with Bernie Sanders. But now I guess they feel jilted or something. I cannot de-emphasize the passion. I mean, it almost puts Trump to shame in terms of all of his hatred. It's really a peculiar phenomenon.
I've spent the last couple of days talking to a lot of these protesters, and people have come here, and it's almost a religious like fervor that people have. You know, I was talking yesterday with one woman. I mean, she didn't have to come far. She was from York, Pennsylvania, in the central part of our state. But, you know, she had no money. She's unemployed. And she hitchhiked to get to Philadelphia because she just felt like she had to be here. I met another group. I spent a part of Sunday at this campground in South New Jersey. It's about 45 minutes from Philadelphia, and these were like the only available campgrounds. And these campgrounds had been taken over by Bernie Sanders supporters. The first group of people I met had just gotten there. They had just caravaned 70 hours from Seattle, Washington, nonstop. They had driven through a group of, I think, five vehicles, maybe altogether, 22 people who had been total strangers before this. They just met over Facebook, and they met at Safeco Field, the baseball stadium in downtown Seattle, and just drove straight to this campground in South Jersey, and they were going to, you know, protest and march in Philadelphia for 4 days and then drive back home. They called it the Journey for Bernie, and it's mystical. It's religious. You know, it just kind of transcends politics. That, you know, I think Bernie Sanders has given meaning to a lot of people. I want to be careful. I don't want to belittle that or minimize it. I mean, I think the passion these people feel is heartfelt, and I think it's motivated by very real problems in this country: income inequality, people's difficulty in finding jobs, people's difficulty in obtaining health care, people's difficulty in paying for a college education, which is something I heard from people again and again and again out on the campaign trail. So it's really something that transcends just the usual political, oh, you know, who's got the most delegates? Well, she's got it. She won. Well, who are we going to support in 2020? You know, it goes beyond that.
Well, but it's a little strange, though, at this point, with this religious kind of fervor that you, I think, accurately describe. But when and they've gone all the way across the country and they've camped out, and it sounds like they're probably having a great time. And
it's, they
and,
are,
and,
yeah.
And frankly, it's great to see young people that engaged in politics. They're normally accused of being rather apathetic.
Right.
And, you know, you can only hope that this energy and enthusiasm and direction continues because the young people are the ones that are going to be inheriting the mess that older folks like you and me have made. So
I couldn't agree with you more, Ian. You know, I would like to see more of a focus on Donald Trump at this point, because I think Donald Trump and the potential of his presidency is just alarming. It's important to put these things in perspective. I mean, in a large nation of more than 300 million people, you know, the people you're seeing here in Philadelphia are the 5,000 just most passionate do-or-die Bernie people. Because, I mean, they came here when everybody else at least knew that, you know, there was no way he was going to get the nomination, and they still came. I mean, that's how passionate they are. I think when you look more broadly, when you go to, like, say, a college campus where you have the vast majority of kids who are supporting Bernie Sanders and talk to them, you know, there's no way that these voters want Donald Trump. And there was a Pew poll, I don't know how accurate it was, but it just came out this week, saying that as many as 90% of Bernie Sanders supporters are already planning to vote for Hillary Clinton. That doesn't mean they love her now. Most of them don't, frankly, but they are willing to vote for her to keep Donald Trump out of the White House. And then that makes sense, you know? I mean, at least you'll have somebody in there who has views that are more acceptable on issues like climate change or abortion rights, or, you know, I can name a dozen issues where her views are in the same direction as Bernie Sanders. Whereas if you got a Republican in the White House, i.e. Donald Trump, everything would change. And then I didn't even mention the Supreme Court, obviously, you know, who's going to appoint the next Supreme Court justices. So I think when you look at all those things, you know, there's another election in 4 years. You know, there's no reason why a progressive can't challenge Hillary Clinton in 2020. Obviously, it's harder if she's the incumbent president. But and the other thing, and I think this dawns on some people, but maybe not enough people, is there's more to politics than just the president. You know, there's the U.S. Congress, there's your state legislature, there's your governor, there's your city council. One of the things that's going to be really interesting to see is, you know, how many people who took part in this Bernie Sanders political revolution are either going to want to run for office themselves or at least support like-minded people who are running for local offices.
Well, of course, Bernie Sanders said much of what you were just saying, Will Bunch, in his speech last night. Particularly, he talked about the Supreme Court. So all of the kind of rational arguments are being made. And, of course, unfortunately, that's always the Democrats usually run on the basis of we're not as bad as the other guys are. And in this case, they really do have a poster boy.
It's hard to disagree with them this time around.
Exactly.
Right?
So that's never been a very persuasive argument. I'm just wondering whether when you have the Sanders supporter and the comedian Sarah Silverman remarking last night to the Bernie or bus people, you're being ridiculous, whether that's going to calm them down or rile them up. I mean, I guess the really concern here is that whether when Hillary Clinton is on Thursday night, her moment of triumph will be in any way marred by a walkout or any booing. That would, of course, be damaging to her.
Right, absolutely. I mean, if you'd asked me on Sunday, I would say that there was still a slight chance of that happening. Right now, I would say the chance of that is like very slight to minimal. It's almost like there would have to be another incident, like the release of these emails, you know, something like that would almost have to have happen between now and Thursday for that to happen at this point. I mean, I think Bernie Sanders' delegates, you know, he has 40% or more than 40% of the delegates here at this convention are supporting Bernie Sanders. I think they're going to go home a little disappointed at how things went down. But I do think at the end of the day, I think most of them are going to be resigned to Hillary Clinton being the person. You know, I mean, the 5,000 people who are out in the streets have a different point of view. I think a lot of them are going to vote for Jill Stein. And look, let's say that Jill Stein gets 1, 2, 3% of the vote in the presidential race, and she may get more than that. She's polling higher. That's a lot of votes. That's hundreds of thousands to 1 to 2 million votes. Well, who are those people going to be? Well, some of them are going to be these 5,000 people out here chanting that how much they dislike Hillary Clinton. So that's not a surprise. We know that some people are going to vote for Jill Stein. Is there going to be a huge movement? I mean, look, I think people from our generation are going to remember what happened in 2000 with Ralph Nader and how we got George W. Bush and how we invaded Iraq and how the economy collapsed. And I think for people who voted in that election, not that I voted for Ralph Nader, but just the fact that we remember that his presence in that election and what it did, I think that's going to influence a lot of people.
Well, particularly if it's close. I mean, how close could you
be?
In Florida,
yeah.
It was only five.
True. Look, I could see a scenario if the Trump campaign really implodes, if there's more disclosures about him, or, you know, we find out that Vladimir Putin's pulling the strings on his campaign, or whatever we find out about Trump in the next 3 months. If his campaign completely implodes and, you know, the week before the election, the polls show that Hillary's winning by 20 points, then, yeah, I could see a lot of liberals saying, hey, you know, if I'm not tipping the election, I don't want to vote for Hillary. I'm going to go on record voting for Jill Stein. I could see that situation happening, which, of course, would make it a closer election. But, you know, if the polls show Trump's within 5 points either way, then I think that's going to really put the kibosh on a lot of support for Jill Stein.
Well, of course, he's 3.5 points ahead.
Right.
So you've got to be nervous about that. And, of course, the Florida example with Ralph Nader, Bush won by 537 votes. I mean, even though Gore had hundreds of thousands more in the popular vote, of course, we have this bizarre antique electoral college system. But just in closing then, Will Bunch, tonight, do you think President Clinton's going to help? I mean, he's the guy that got rid of Glass-Steagall.
You know, I don't know. I mean, we talk so much about Clinton fatigue, but you know, I'm just speaking solely for myself personally, but, you know, I'm wondering what Bill Clinton has left to say that I haven't heard from him, you know, going back to the 1980s. If you're a political junkie, you probably saw him speak in 1988 for Michael Dukakis, you know. I mean, so this, I understand this is the 10th time that he's addressed a Democratic National Convention. But then I say that, but then you go back to the 9th time he spoke in 2012 on behalf of Obama, and that speech really helped cement Obama's support. So I don't know. It merits watching. We'll see, you know, maybe it'll be a 2012 moment, or maybe people will roll their eyes and say, oh, my God, this guy again.
Right.
You know.
And I thank you. Well, we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate it.
I do, too. And again, I've been speaking with Will Bunch, who's an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. He blogs at Attitude, that's spelled ATTYTOOD.com, and he's the author of The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama, and his latest book is The Burn Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Mark Maxwell and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 4 p.m., which is an hour earlier than normally because of Pacifica's national coverage of the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Of course, the program is always available at ianmasters.com. Bye for now.